Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's no surprise that the signature war wound of Iraq and Afghanistan is traumatic brain injury. We've known about it for years. But a recent investigation by NPR's Daniel Zwerdling and ProPublica's T. Christian Miller found that many soldiers returning from these wars still don't get proper diagnosis or care. A year ago, Sergeant Victor Medina was caught in an IED blast in Iraq. He's struggled to get help for his brain injury. Here he talks with Daniel Zwerdling.
The doctors, they have hurt me.
You say the doctors here have hurt you.
Yeah. You know, Warrior Ethos says, I will never leave a fallen comrade. I feel that the system left me behind.
This hour, On Point, returning war vets and traumatic brain injury. You can join the conversation. Is this your story? Have you seen traumatic brain injury firsthand? And how do we ensure veterans get the care they need? Joining me now from Washington is Daniel Zwerdling, investigative reporter and correspondent at NPR's National Desk. Daniel, Danny, thanks for being here. Welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks a lot.
And with us from Washington is T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica. He and Danny Zwerdling collaborated on the recent traumatic brain injury investigation. T. Christian Miller, T., welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
You all know this material very, very well, but if you'd be kind enough to sit back for just a second, I want to listen back to some of the voices that you brought listeners here on this subject. Here's Michelle Diarmid, a former major in the Army Reserves, who experienced two roadside bomb blasts in Iraq in 2005. Here she describes what happened in and after the blast.
And there was so much dust and dirt and debris flying around. We had to wait like 2 minutes for it to settle. I realized I had a screaming bad headache. Take the worst headache you've ever had and multiply it by about 1,000. And I've had an ongoing headache ever since.
Our soldier, now home. Here's another bit. While serving in Iraq, Sergeant William Frost was in so many explosions, he stopped keeping track. After returning to Fort Bliss 2 years ago, he tried to get help after realizing he could no longer drive. Here, he and his wife, Marie, talk about being unable to find help.
I called and called and called. I was hurting.
You'd think commanders would listen to Frost. He got a Bronze Star with Valor. The citation reads like a movie. His unit was pinned down in a 7-hour battle, and he helped save his major and a group of Iraqi troops.
I'm a senior non-commissioned officer. And I couldn't get help. I couldn't get help.
I still can't make sense of it. There's no help from the military.
You know, the top officials of the Pentagon say we have started programs around the world to help soldiers with traumatic brain injury.
Can I swear? It's bull.
That's bull, said Marie. And here, one more. General Peter Corelli, Vice Chief of Staff to the U.S. Army, Daniel Zwerdling, asked Corelli if he could estimate how many soldiers suffered from traumatic brain injury.
I can't. I can't tell you how many do.
And do you worry about those soldiers?
Of course I worry about those soldiers.
And Corelli says it's true. A lot of military doctors still don't diagnose traumatic brain injuries when they should.
Well, invisible wounds are definitely going to play second fiddle to blood and missing appendages or gunshot wounds.
And the general says here's part of the problem. Despite all the rhetoric about signature injuries, many people in the military still don't believe that TBIs are a serious problem.
We've got to change the culture of the Army. We've got to change the culture of society. We don't want to recognize things we can't see.
Maybe it's easier that way, but not easy for the veterans who suffer with brain injury. Daniel Zwerdling and T. Christian Miller join us from Washington. We're really, honored that you're here. Congratulations on doing this reporting. We want to keep track of veterans and what they're up against. I mean, Jamie Tarabay's story this morning on suicide makes us think in really fatal dimensions here. But, Danny, why did you go after this angle? Were you seeing evidence that this was not being fully addressed?
When you go back to the beginning of the war, within about a year, the military doctors and commanders realized that there was this problem, you know, all the explosions going off, and soldiers were coming in from their missions dazed, confused. And there actually had been research for decades about the effects of blasts on soldiers, going back at least to the war between Israel and Egypt in the 1970s. And then as the war in Iraq and Afghanistan dragged on, top government officials in the mid-1980s started talking about traumatic brain injury as the signature injury of the war. Mm-hmm. You've used that phrase yourself, Tom. Mm-hmm. And top leaders on the Congress, everybody started saying, we need major programs to diagnose and treat soldiers with TBI. So Congress voted hundreds of millions of dollars for programs. The government set up centers to start researching traumatic brain injury.
That sounds great.
It sounds great. And we said, all right, but let's look at the track record. Let's look to what extent the rhetoric and the national policies are playing out on the ground where the soldiers actually eat and breathe and unfortunately die and get injured. So we just, you know, wanted to see what's really happening.
T. Christian Miller, what did you find, first of all, in the numbers? How many have been identified as cases that the military is treating? How many haven't?
Well, that's one of the first things that we found, Tom, was that the numbers were all over the place and that nobody could give us good numbers, which was a clue to how serious the problem was. Even today, when you go and talk to senior military medical people and ask them, do you think that your own official statistics are right? They'll say, no, we don't. And we don't think we've got a full handle on this problem. So the number you'll hear from the military is that there's about 115,000 soldiers who suffered mild traumatic brain injuries. What our reporting found is that number is probably much higher, and that a lot of those soldiers recover from these mild traumatic brain injuries. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain percentage of them that are going to go on, or you're going to have the sort of cognitive problems, sort of memory and concentration problems you heard from Michelle DeArmond or you heard mm-hmm. from Sergeant Billy Frost.
In fact, we should talk for a moment, Tom, about what so-called mild traumatic brain injury means.
No, we should, because our emotions are so keyed to empathy here to veterans these days. And but when you say mild, you know, I mean, I'm thinking, is that like, I don't know, kid playing, you know, Pop Warner football, gets a concussion? We've learned that's not a small thing, but what are we talking about?
Well, let's go to the blast. So a bomb goes off. It sends out a shockwave. And people who have seen explosions say you actually can see the shockwave rippling through the air.
In the air.
Almost like in a science fiction film. Mm-hmm. And those shockwaves go through metal. They go through helmets. They go through skulls. They go through the brain. And studies show that these shockwaves damage the brain on a very, almost invisible level, invisible certain mm-hmm. to CAT scans, to MRIs. They damage the brain in ways that researchers still don't fully understand. But what they do know is that even if your head does not look visibly injured, even if you're not bleeding anywhere, that this can cause terrible cognition problems. And the soldiers we talked to, for example, months or years after these blasts, a soldier tells us, you know, that he used to devour novels every week. Mm-hmm. Well, now he reads one paragraph and he forgets what he just read. Another soldier, Brandon Sanford, used to help his son with his homework, a little boy who's now mm-hmm. 10. He mm-hmm. can't comprehend that homework anymore. Another soldier... Actually, every soldier would say, I used to be a great multitasker. You know, man, I could do five things at once and be totally tight and under control. Mm-hmm. And now if I can at most focus on one thing, and even then it's a struggle. And the term mild, why don't you take that? Because mild does not mean what lay people think.
Right. That's exactly what we heard over and over again. The term mild brain injury doesn't mean it's mild consequences. It's a purely technical description, somewhat arbitrary, which means that the soldier has lost consciousness for less than 30 minutes or has just had his bell rung or has mm-hmm. seen stars. Mm-hmm. So mild is simply a medical term which is used to describe sort of a period of time or a certain number of minutes that the soldier has been unconscious. It doesn't mean that there aren't very, very serious effects from mild traumatic brain injury.
What's the military saying about this? Are they saying, well, it's mild and we're not worried about it, or we're just missing it, or it's being covered up in the field? I mean, how can there be a tens of thousands discrepancy between their number and perhaps yours?
There's all kinds of reasons for that, and it starts on the battlefield. If you're a medic and you are treating a number of soldiers who've been in a blast where you've got to deal with missing limbs, where you're having to deal with soldiers who are close to dying, those are your first people you're going to treat. And so the guys who have an invisible wound are going to not be as noted. They're not going to be – their injuries might not even be documented because the medic has to deal with what's in front of him. You also see soldiers who they want to be back on the battlefield with their comrades, and they'll shake off an injury just as you'll see in the NFL. A team mm-hmm. guy gets knocked out, and he wants to get back on the field with his players. But then you also do see there are some people in the military, and the military is a great big organization, and they have all sorts of different schools of thought. But there are certain schools of thought within the military which also sort of shake off the idea that a concussion can lead to serious consequences, or at least that it may not be as serious as has been portrayed.
And there's something else. This is really astonishing. You would think that the military, right, the U.S. military is the most record-obsessed institution in the world, right? Write it down. Put it in the computers. Mm-hmm. We were stunned at how terrible the medical record keeping has been in Iraq and Afghanistan. We talked to senior people in the military's medical systems who said that from the field all the way to the bases here, records simply are not kept, or to the extent they're kept, they disappear. So that there would be, you know, file cabinets filled with medical records saying that you, Tom, had a traumatic brain injury in Iraq, and that record would be sitting in some dusty town somewhere, forgotten and abandoned, and it never makes it into your permanent medical record.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraq and Afghan war vets coming home with traumatic brain injury and struggling to get treatment. Daniel Zwerdling of NPR joins us from Washington, as does T. Christian Miller, senior reporter at ProPublica. They did a deep investigation of what's going on with brain injuries, who's getting treated, who's not, and why. You can join the conversation this hour. Have you seen this story play out in your family, your community? Have you or a loved one struggled with brain injury after war duty in the last decade? What's it like? How's it feel? What's your treatment been? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. A lot of great tape tells the story. Danny T. Christian Miller, please stand by. I want to listen to a little more here. Here's Sergeant Victor Medina again. We heard him at the top of the hour, 34 years old, suffered a brain injury just last summer when an IED hit his truck in Iraq. He has video of the explosion, and here he is showing Danny Zwerdling footage of the actual blast.
I'm in front of them. I'm in that vehicle right there.
They're passing palm trees and scrubby fields on the right. Suddenly, there's a yellow flash near Medina's door.
Go, IED!
Then a mean black and gray cloud.
Go, Lang! Go, Lang!
Medina's fellow soldiers say he tore off his seatbelt and he checked his men to make sure they were okay. Then, Victor Medina collapsed.
We've got to get out of here. 1 week after that IED blast in Iraq, the one that injured Victor Medina, he Skyped with his wife, Roxana. She noticed that something was seriously wrong. She talks to Danny.
It was his left side. Was like droopy face. His eye would go down. His smile would go down. And his cheeks in the left side would go down.
So you're describing a little bit what people look like after they've had a stroke.
That's how he looked like. And then he started mentioning, I have headaches, I'm having memory problems, I cannot concentrate. And I said, what is going on? He said, this is so overwhelming. That's why he said, this is overwhelming. I feel like I'm not in my body. Hmm. And I said, okay, so tomorrow morning, as soon as you get up, you go to the doctor.
Sergeant Victor Medina did go to the doctor. When he got back to Fort Bliss in Texas, he met with the doctor twice. After the second visit, the doctor wrote in the records, T. Christian Miller and Daniel Zwerdling have brought this to light, I'm concerned that he, Medina, may be slipping into a cycle of playing the sick role. Here, Victor Medina responds to that assessment.
When this is the doctor that tells me I'm playing sick, you know that the thought came across my mind. Am I going crazy? It's just like I have to struggle to get to treat it.
That is hard to listen to. We want these vets to have the right treatment. Daniel Zwerdling and T. Chris Jamila join us from Washington. Lots of callers. Waynesboro, Virginia. James, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Great.
I got to say this because it's real important to me. I'm from a military family. It seems to me like the government is doing the exact same thing with traumatic brain injury that they did back in the Vietnam War with Agent Orange, or what they did during the first Gulf War with Gulf War Syndrome. They are denying that it is their fault, because if it's not their fault, then they don't have to pay for it. That young lady earlier who said that this was male bovine fecal material is absolutely correct. It is. That's the way they work.
James, we've got it. Danny, T. Christian Miller, you hear that, you know, the suspicion goes right there. What about that?
That caller is actually correct. We have talked to a number of military people who, some publicly and some privately, will talk about their fears that they are creating, that the idea that traumatic brain injury is so widespread and is creating another expensive syndrome that the military is going to have to deal with going down the road that will cost a lot of money. We already know from Defense Secretary Gates recently spoke about the high cost that the military is now facing in terms of it's having to pay medical bills. This is definitely an issue the military is worried about. They're going to have to pay a lot of money to treat these soldiers. And they know that from past experiences, just as James said, that there have been, each war has had an injury which has cost quite a bit of money. Traumatic brain injury is one of them. There's also things like PTSD. These are going to be around for a long time.
And there's also a little bit of an analogy, I don't want to stretch it too far, between how difficult it was to pin down Agent Orange and its effects, and the difficulty pinning down PTSD and TBI. Some people in the military will tell you, and it's true, there's no single test. You don't put somebody's head into some, you know, special X-ray machine, and you push a button and it says ding, TBI or PTSD. You know, these are diagnoses that take experienced clinicians to make. But on the other hand, it's not like it's totally rocket science, and there are decades of experience, with experts treating people who've been in various wars who know how to diagnose it. So on the one hand, yes, it's not easy to diagnose. On the other hand, it's, you know, when people in the military make it seem like it's impossible, that's a grotesque exaggeration.
You certainly ran into people saying that not enough was being done and too much was being ignored. There's some tape here from Major Remington Nevin, Army epidemiologist, served in Afghanistan, who's really pushing for better documentation, at least, of these injuries, saying that TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, aren't being addressed adequately.
The senior levels of leadership that should be responsible for this issue either don't care, can't understand the problem due to lack of experience, or are so disengaged that they haven't fixed it.
And T. Christian Miller, when you two showed up investigating this, there was a kind of what looked like a stonewalling that was ordained from Washington.
Absolutely right, Tom. We had begun investigating and reporting on the story, and about in the middle of that process, we were given a copy of an email, which Lieutenant General Eric Schoomaker, who is the Army Surgeon General, and he's the highest-ranking medical official in the Army, he sent out an email to all his local commanders and said, don't do any more interviews with NPR and ProPublica on this topic. And we confronted him with that email, and he said that it was because he wanted to standardize the message. But in point of fact, anyone who would read that message would see it as a chilling effect and would be nervous about speaking out about this topic.
I've got tape here where Danny Zwerdling confronts General Schoomaker, Surgeon General of the Army, highest-ranking medical official in the Army, on exactly those emails.
These are very flat emails. Keep quiet. Do not talk to people like NPR and ProPublica.
You didn't read the first part. It says, in order to standardize responses and information with non-DOD audiences.
But standardizing responses, I think a lot of people interpret that as let's have the same corporate line. Let's make sure nobody says something that we don't want them to say.
Listen, if we're not doing things in a standardized way, we need to hear from people. This is to make sure that whomever is speaking from the corporate perspective understands what the corporate strategy is.
The corporate perspective. Danny Zorling, did you ever feel like you and T. Christian Miller were beating up inappropriately on the Army for a kind of a marginal issue here?
You know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. Wow. T said something earlier that is very important. He talked about how there are different voices in the military. It's mm-hmm. important for people to remember that there are millions of people in the U.S. military. The population of the U.S. military, when you combine all the services, is bigger than some countries. So you think about all the different factions in a country. And I think that helps put what's happening here in a more understandable light, which is that there are people at all levels, high levels, bottom levels, in the middle, who care deeply mm-hmm. about this issue, traumatic brain injury and other injuries of the war, and are, you know, just doing everything they can to make things better. At the same time, there are people sitting right next to them or right over them who, you know, just dismiss these problems and think it's a lot of whining and complaining about nothing. So there's a lot of factions here. And the reason we got these emails in the first place was because people at very senior levels are terribly upset with what they see going on, and they're hoping that journalists like us can bring them, you know, to light.
Let's go to Aaron in Beverly, Massachusetts. Aaron, you're on the air with Danny Zorling and T. Christian Miller.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think this is a really important issue. My question really is, what would treatment look like? Because, I mean, we said earlier we don't even understand the effects of a shockwave going through the brain. I mean, imagine a best-case scenario if we had all the funding, if we had, you know, all of the awareness. What can we be doing or not doing?
It's a great question, Aaron. If I may, I'd like to start that all the way out in the field before we even get back here, because your reporting makes it clear you've got to have a kind of line of communication there. Here's a little bit of tape, Danny, where you're talking again with Major Remington Nevin, the Army epidemiologist, about issues with even the documentation of what's going on.
So Remington Nevin says when troops who have traumatic brain injuries come back to the States,
the fact they were in an IED blast is not documented.
In other words, months later, when the soldier is having trouble thinking, having trouble reading, having trouble remembering, doctors might say,
well, there's no evidence you were in a blast. I don't see it in your medical records. Stop complaining.
There's a problem. Danny, take us from the field all the way back to full treatment. If it were there, if it were ideal, if we could do it, what would that whole line look like?
We talked to some of the leading brain experts in the United States, some of the leading brain experts in the world. And they say that over the last 3 or 4 decades, people in the field of brain injury, mainly in the civilian world, have developed something called cognitive rehabilitation. Now, I'm not a doctor, so I can't explain it as well as they could, but it has been laid out in medical journals, and there have been, you know, many, many studies looking at this. And what it is, you take somebody, let's say you, Tom, God forbid you had a traumatic brain injury from a blast. Mm. There are all kinds of very elaborate neuropsychological tests which pinpoint, you know, what part of your cognitive functioning isn't working quite right. Mm-hmm. Is it your attention? Is it your long-term memory, short-term memory, et cetera, et cetera? And then based on you and what the scores show and what the your history shows, they come up with a very detailed program which is designed to help you figure out new ways to do what your brain can't do the old way anymore.
And so that's possible? The brain is famously plastic. It can find workarounds?
Exactly. Workarounds. I think that's a good way of describing it. They talk about learning to compensate. And one leading brain specialist said, think of it this way. If you get a hip injury and nobody gives you rehab, you're going to start walking crooked, and then your shoulder's going to be off, your spine's going to be off, and your whole body is going to start, you know, having horrible problems. But we can't replace your hip to be as perfect as it used to be with this hip injury. But if we start teaching you how to hold yourself, how to balance differently, how to use your arms when you walk, you can compensate and learn a whole new way of walking that, you know, is very fluid, but is not exactly the way it used to be.
But that sounds like something that's going to take sustained attention, care, certainly not being ignored.
Yes, that's exactly the issue. And when we get back to these issues of what does the military want to pay for, cognitive rehabilitative therapy is a very intensive therapy. It can be quite costly. It can take quite a long time. That means taking soldiers off the battlefield. That means paying more into military budgets. These are all big issues the military is wrestling with right now.
Now, it's not as if we went to one base where Victor Medina is, Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas.
Big one.
And it's not as if these soldiers weren't getting any care. Now, they were. The problem is, and one leading brain specialist said to us, Here's what it is. The care they're getting at these bases mm-hmm. is sort of like junior high school, and what they need is graduate school.
Yeah. Let's go to Glasgow, Kentucky, and David. David, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Hello. I just wanted to make a quick comment and then a question. As a former officer in the National Guard, it was easier to have a soldier diagnosed with PTSD than it was MTBI. And then my question is, and I'll take this off air, is it easier for active duty soldiers to be diagnosed and taken care of than National Guard soldiers?
Those are both interesting questions, David. Thank you for your call. Danny, T, what about it? Do you see PTSD now getting more tentative response than brain injury?
Well, you know, it's interesting when you look at the history of the war. For years, post-traumatic stress disorder was ignored. And in 2006, I did a series of investigative reports showing how officers at another major base, Fort Carson in Colorado, how they were punishing troops who said, I am falling apart, I can't sleep, I fly into rages. They had post-traumatic stress disorder, and nobody wanted to recognize it. Well, mm-hmm. now there's been so much publicity about PTSD, and Congress got upset, that now the military, in its reactive mode, which is a common way the military mm-hmm. acts, it reacts, it went into high gear on, we've got to train everybody to deal with PTSD, which is good. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the military sort of seizes on the problem of the moment, you know, the one that's yeah. getting the most political and public attention. So now it's almost as if they're almost overemphasizing PTSD and don't want to hear about anything else like blast injuries.
What about the question from Kentucky, T, on National Guard versus other troops and the quality of care?
Well, I also want to get back to this issue because we don't want to simplify things here, because what David's pointing out is that actually PTSD and TBI often coexist, and it makes sense. Mm-hmm. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is caused by a terrifying event. What could be more terrifying than having a bomb blast go off right next to your convoy yeah, yeah. or right next to your foot patrol? Mm-hmm. So that same injury that's going to cause that blast wave, which is going to cause that traumatic brain injury, physically injure the brain, is also often going to result in a diagnosis of PTSD. So you're going to have a lot of overlap, and that's difficult. We're not trying to make it seem like it's easy to separate out those two, and that they often do occur together.
Understood.
The same. So you're going to also have soldiers that just have traumatic brain injury. You're going to have soldiers that have both, and you're going to have soldiers that just have post-traumatic stress disorder. The smartest way that the experts we talk to say is you've got to be able to treat and be able to deal with all three of those different populations of soldiers.
And the Guard question, so many National Guard have gone to Iraq.
Yeah, it's a fabulous question. You have about 500,000 of the 2 million troops that have now served in Iraq and Afghanistan were either National Guard or reservists. We just spoke recently with a veterans advocate who described that population of soldiers as kind of the Bermuda Triangle, because they're much more difficult to track. They return to their civilian lives. The military doesn't necessarily have any visibility into what kind of treatment, what kind of diagnoses they're getting. So we'd like to hear from reservists. We'd like to hear from National Guards. And at ProPublica, we've set up a call-out box where we're taking information at ProPublica.org/TBI. Mm-hmm. And we really encourage your listeners, Tom, to go in and fill it. We have a form there where we're trying to get in touch with some of these reservists, these National Guard, and find out what are your experiences like, because they're very difficult to track.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraq and Afghan war vets coming home with traumatic brain injury and struggling for treatment. It's a situation brought richly to life by T. Christian Miller of ProPublica and NPR investigative reporter Daniel Zwerdling in big reports that have really put this front and center. Tens of thousands, they say, not being properly cared for when they come home from these wars. Danny and T. Christian Miller join us from Washington. Joining me right now from Boston is Jamie Zagami. Her brother, Jonathan, John, was diagnosed with PTSD and traumatic brain injury after serving 14 months in Iraq, 2003, 2004. He suffered 3 head injuries there, 2 from blasts, 1 from a vicious kick to the head, and it has been a long road for Jonathan, and Jamie, his sister. They're very close. She joins us now. Jamie, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We read about your story in the Boston Globe. I mean, it's really heartrending. You have been the sister of sisters for this brother. You've stood up in a million ways with and for him. But this combination of PTSD and TBI, traumatic brain injury, is one that is just really hard to get around. Tell us the kind of difficulties that John's working with now, and you as his sister.
Absolutely, Tom. When John first returned home, you know, we could tell almost immediately that he had changed in terms of personality. So we were pretty sure after a few months of him not coming around to being the outgoing, affable young teenager mm-hmm. that he was when he left, that something was going on, and assumed that it was probably PTSD. a few months after that, John and I started our freshman year at UMass Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too long after classes began that I started to notice he had some difficulty with academics that he might not have had before. I chalked it up to, you know, he's been out of school now for over a year. He's
right.
been in a much different lifestyle. But it wasn't too long after that, it was the beginning of the second semester, where John actually suffered from a stroke. It was in that hospital visit that we found out that he had suffered multiple blasts overseas and was knocked out on several occasions. And that's when he was diagnosed with TBI.
And, I mean, this is in a context where he's having night terrors, you know, freaking yeah. out at his roommates, exhausted but can't sleep, and nothing's going
not
right.
Not able
his
to focus.
Emotions all over the place.
Horrible headaches.
But it took a stroke back in the States for them to, what, sort of connect the dots back to these three tough head injuries
yeah.
in Iraq?
Yeah, John didn't, in his words, didn't want to upset our family any more than he already had by being overseas
mm-hmm.
In terms of putting us through anymore. So he didn't tell us that he had sustained any injuries overseas. We were just thrilled to have him home. You know, he was in one piece.
Yeah.
We couldn't have felt any more lucky to have him back. And it wasn't until he was hospitalized that his medical records had shown those head injuries overseas, which resulted in the stroke when he came home.
So you know about them now. What happened in those incidents in Iraq?
I know some of them were from mortar fire, a blast, and I know that one of them was during crowd control. John was actually kicked in the back of the head.
Kicked really hard?
Yes, and he was knocked out for several hours.
What's your experience of treatment been at this point?
It's been a very difficult and long road. It's, you know, almost 5 years now, or it is 5 years now. And John had been sort of ping-ponged back and forth between Walter Reed in D.C., up to West Point in New York, the VA here in Boston. But there didn't seem to be a connection between all of his physicians and all of the work that they were doing. So there was a lot of repetition. There was a lot of losing different documents. Recently, we've been involved with the first private venture of its kind, which is the Red Sox Foundation and Mass General came together and formed the Home Base Program. So John is now seeking treatment through them.
So not through the VA, but there. Who came up with the diagnosis of traumatic brain injury? Was
the
that
VA.
The military? That was the VA. So they get credit due. They saw it. They recognized it.
They did, yes.
But it took a stroke for that to happen.
Yeah. Yep.
T. Christian Miller, Danny Zwirling in Washington, what are you hearing in this story?
Unfortunately, Jamie, and hi, thanks for sharing this with us. Unfortunately, the same story we've heard over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's astonishing, Jamie. What you're telling us is the same thing that we've heard in many different places. It's just a struggle to get recognition, a struggle to get care. Often at the end of that tunnel, you will get a diagnosis, but it takes an advocate like yourself for the soldier to really bring that to bear, because these soldiers who have these traumatic brain injuries, by definition, they're having trouble concentrating, they're having trouble making decisions, they're having trouble focusing. So to leave the medical care to that soldier is a real difficult proposition, and it often takes a family member, a wife, a loved one, to get it to where it needs to be.
In one case, one of the soldiers we met, and Brandon Sanford, his mother flew to, you know, here's a guy who's a warrior, right, who
yeah.
is fighting overseas. His mother flies like he's a little kid in school to Fort Bliss to try to, you know, raise hell and get some better treatment. And it takes that sort of family support intervening because he just did not have the, you know, he just, his brain just could not focus on the issue and make it happen for himself.
Let me take a call from Boston right here. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Listen, I've worked in traumatic brain injury for decades, and most recently at Spalding, on a federally funded study called the Traumatic Brain Injury Model System Project. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The government knows everything they need to know. Everybody knows. It's all in the research. But what your great reporters are not talking enough about, but Jamie's touching on it, mm-hmm. is the impact that this has not only on a family and a community, but on children of brain injury people, on spouses. I mean, people with brain injuries frequently are not the same people ever. And for children to be raised by a parent who has disinhibition and has temper issues and is verbally abusive destroys the next generation. And this is what everybody's wow. missing, is that this is attacking an entire generation, and the ramifications are it's just overwhelming. But your information is great, but there is so much more beneath this that we need to know to keep our society, our culture, our communities together.
The whole nimbus around this. I'm glad you raised that, Elizabeth. I mean, Jamie, you I know from reading you've seen that firsthand with John. It is tough. It is very tough to just to be in the or tough for him, but tough to be in that orbit.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's really hard to love someone and have them kind of push you away and act, you know, kind of as a different person and not be able to reason with them or rationalize with them because they're just not capable of it.
I've got more questions on that, but let me get a call from Manchester, Connecticut. Paul, you're on the air, maybe on the same vein.
Thank you, Tom. I have been a psychotherapist and a medical massage therapist now since 1974. I appreciate Jamie's comments, and I do not wish to demean them in any way whatsoever. But I've heard this story at least 3,000 times. I have stopped keeping track of how many TBI and PTSD cases I have taken care of since 1974. In 1976, after the Treaty of Paris in Vietnam, my only solution for working with PTSD was to encourage every family to sue the federal government. There was no response. They didn't have the money. They didn't have the power. Nobody cared. And since the Gulf War 1 and 2, my business has thrived. Since Iraq and Afghanistan, my business has thrived. I'm 61 years old. I can't even begin to tell you how tired I am of seeing Jamie's and wives and loved ones coming in and begging me to work with their individual.
Their brother, their husband, their son. Paul, I appreciate your call. Danny, T. Christian Miller, you hear in our caller Elizabeth, in Paul and Jamie's own story, I mean, the reference to the sort of wider circle of damage that goes on here.
One of the leading brain specialists in the country said, picture this scenario. The guy or the mother comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan. They have a 10-year-old child. The parent decides, okay, I'm going to go with him to the soccer game. And because of the brain injury, one of the common symptoms is you can't stand noise. You can't stand crowds. Also, that's common with post-traumatic stress disorder. So these parents go to the top of the stands. They feel like they're going nuts with the cheering. They try to put a blanket over their head. You know, the child is looking up, seeing this parent looking like a freak. The child is, you know, falling apart. Then the parent comes down after the game, flies off the handle, starts yelling at the child. Then can't remember, you know, where they were supposed to meet the mother after the. I mean, you think, you know, it's some of the times I thought I was going to lose it during interviews mm-hmm. was when I was talking to the children. Of these soldiers.
Yeah, here's a question from WNED in Buffalo, a speech pathologist there, asking that we touch on the subtleties in diagnosing this. I mean, we want to be fully sympathetic, but what about the subtleties? And when you get into it, T, Danny, is it obvious when this is there, in the absence of a stroke or something that puts everything front and center?
The short answer to that question is that it's not always obvious, and we don't mean to suggest, as Danny mentioned earlier, that there's a magic machine where you can automatically diagnose mild traumatic brain injury or these effects. It's not easy. And when you have hundreds of thousands of soldiers coming back, the military is faced with how are we going to diagnose these guys? So a lot of times they rely upon these screens to figure out what's going on. These screens are not particularly effective, we found. They miss a lot of soldiers. They identify a lot of soldiers falsely. So we don't mean to minimize the difficulty which the military is facing in trying to understand this population. It is not easy. It does take trained clinicians. It does take a lot of effort to figure out and tease out, is this a PTSD case? Is this a TBI case? Mm-hmm. Our story was just pointing out that a lot of times they're not diagnosing these guys, and there needs to be an effort to do that.
Yeah, you look at the field tests, though, and how they almost seem designed sometimes to brush by the problem in the first instance, right there in the first follow-up in the field.
Well, Congress, a few years ago, Congress said, look, to the military, they said, look, we want you to screen everybody after they've been in a blast to see if they have a traumatic brain injury. But we found that these tests have been basically a fiasco. The military has sent two tests to the field. One is called the MACE, one is called the ANAM. And they're a little bit like tests we all took earlier in school where you have to remember numbers backwards or remember words, that sort of thing. And they measure how fast your brain works, how well your memory is working, things like that. And we found that there is widespread, first of all, one of those tests is almost never used in the field. Doctors just don't use it. And the second test is the medics who administer the tests often help the soldiers cheat.
They're prompting them,
and there's a very complex thing here. On the one hand, the military, you know, the commanders want the soldiers back in the field as fast as possible. Yeah. And the soldiers, the troops themselves, want to get back in the field as fast as possible because they feel the sense of honor and duty. They want to be with their brothers. So these troops and the medics together cheat, and the medics prompt them and tell them the questions over and over till they get them right.
Here's Colonel James Bunshock at Fort Bliss, the hospital commander there, talking about if soldiers may have been overlooked or fallen through the cracks. He says it's because sometimes it's hard for them to ask for help.
These are high-performing folks. These are America's best, quite frankly. And it's tough for them to step forward and say, I need some help.
Let's take a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Austin. Austin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm actually a military man myself. I've been two Ranger battalions, spent time in the 25th Infantry Division in Iraq and four tours in Afghanistan.
Thank you.
I wanted to touch on something that I don't think is really talked about too often. With active duty soldiers, what I've noticed is that active duty infantrymen, especially people who've trained for combat, well, we do this stuff every day, and special operations guys, we know it's coming, you know, and nothing can really prepare you for it anyway. It doesn't matter how much training you have. But I think one of the worst things is a lot of National Guard units when they get activated and come over there, and then they see the same things, and they never, a lot of those guys that I've talked to never expected to have to go to war. They never expected at any point to actually have to fight. They'd expected, you know, to do mostly disaster preparation and things like that around the country. And then when they get over there, they're doing the same things that we were all trained for as infantrymen, and there are infantrymen in the National Guard. I just think they expect to be part-time always.
But they're thrown into the thick of it. I mean, Austin, I understand your observation when it comes to PTSD. But when it comes to traumatic brain injury, whether you're extremely well-trained, Army Ranger or a guardsman who didn't expect to be there, I mean, isn't this the effect the same if you're really whacked in the head?
Oh, no, it's definitely true. It's definitely true. The traumatic brain injury and PTSD, I don't say they're related by any means necessarily, but it's a definite easy thing. I've had several concussions myself. Luckily, thankfully, I had mine spaced out a long ways between each other. I was able to heal between each one, I believe. As far as I know, I don't think I have any traumatic brain injury. I haven't had any effects of it so far. But anybody can suffer that kind of thing. You know, it's just how it works.
Yeah, Austin, we appreciate your service and appreciate your call. Danny, you know, there's an Army Ranger looking sort of at that intersection of PTSD and traumatic brain injury. But once you're there and the explosion goes off, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a superhero. It's going to hit your brain.
And you played a clip just a couple of minutes ago of Colonel James Bonchak, who runs the medical center at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas. Mm-hmm. He was saying if soldiers fall through the cracks, it's because they are afraid to come forward. That sometimes that's true that many troops don't want to come forward or are afraid to come forward, but it's also true that the military's job is to diagnose and screen these people. You know, when you go to the doctor, And you don't want to get treatment. The doctor doesn't just let you walk out. So it's the military's job to screen them after explosions, which, as I just mentioned, is not happening many, many times. It's the military's job to diagnose these injuries, which doctors are not doing often. And at Fort Bliss itself, we talked to many soldiers who gave us detailed stories about how they and their family members were kicking and screaming trying to get help. They complained to their congressman. They asked their congressman to investigate Fort Bliss. They wrote to commanders. So for James Bonchuk, the head of the medical center, to say they're not coming forward, it's simply not true.
You know, we heard it right there in the testimony that you all have on tape. Here's a web comment that says, "This is why war is always supposed to be the last resort and not a way of life. We don't just rain ruin on our enemy. We ruin a generation of our own." Let's hope not. Let's do everything we can not to have that be the case. Jamie Zagame, we wish the best to your brother John in his rehabilitation, and to you, a big admiration for the way you're supporting him. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tom.
And T. Christian Miller with ProPublica, thank you for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Daniel Zwerdling, it's always impressive to see what you bring back for the country. Thanks for this reporting, Danny. Thanks for being here today.
Tom, thanks for spending the time on this important issue.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.